much for coming. Welcome back to Rutgers, those of you who have been here before. Welcome to Rutgers, those of you who have not been here before. It was Physics Tuesday, I'm pretty sure.
No, Organic Chemistry.
What's that? Oh, you were going to chemistry class?
Organic Chemistry.
Oh, sorry. All right. Oh, I would have guessed that anyway. I just thought it was really easy because the number of the class in the classroom match. They try to do that all the time. I'm a professor in the computer science department. I've been trying to put together this intro class. I'm glad that you're willing participants in it. And today, mostly, I would like to introduce the class to you and talk about one topic and kind of get an idea of where you are and give you an idea of where I am. And we'll just kind of use that to get off the ground. So, what have we got? So, I did teach this last semester as a topics class, but now it's officially in the course catalog. It has a lower number now, so as not to scare off people, I guess. There's a couple things I'm going to try different this semester than last semester. I'm going to see if I can use Rutgers Online course support that they're pushing. It seems like it could be a useful thing if it's something that you were familiar with. Last year, we just did things casually by email, by and large. I'm experimenting with iClickers for in-class interaction. See how that all works out. Possibly a very interesting use of the technology. And we'll try as best I can to get some programs out to you that you can run on your own to play with so you can have more out-of-class interaction with some of the ideas that we're going to talk about. Not organic chemistry, right? You here for organic chemistry? No. Perfect. CS stuff?
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. So let's start off. Let's do a survey. The bookstore supposedly knew that the clickers were going to be used in this class, so it's possible that you have a clicker, it's possible that you don't. If you don't have a clicker, press no, A on your clicker. Otherwise, oh damn, this is not going to work. You can't see it anymore. Hang on 1 second. This worked at home because I didn't have 2 screens, so you can't see what the choices are when I go in and actually collect data. This would be something that would be nice to be able to. So now this is just way too big and you can't see it either. I can shrink the window. Great idea.
Do you have a MacBook controller or a clicker?
Say again?
Is a MacBook controller or a clicker?
I don't know, but we can experiment with it. My understanding of current clicker technology, and I'm sure this can be different in 5 years, is that they're completely unstandardized. So every clicker is different from every other clicker, and every company makes you get there. Sort of where the rest of the world was before USB was invented. All right. Zoom. Out. So I came yesterday to check out the classroom so that there wouldn't be any problems at all the first day. But there were people in here, and I didn't actually try anything. All right, this might do it. Is there a graph in there? I don't know how they got there. Okay, so we're gonna try this again. So, you can see it. See, that's just a bug. That is just a bug. Oh, it's a fixable bug, here we go. No, it's not a fixable bug. You've got 15 seconds. If you have a clicker, please press B. If you don't have a clicker, please press A. And 5 more seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, in principle, I should be able to pull up a display with the bar chart. So there's one person who clicked yes. Is that true? Did somebody have that? You actually have one and you pushed yes? Good. And you pushed one, but it didn't come up?
No, I'm sorry. What program are you using?
Define program. You mean which, like for the slides or for the clicker?
I guess for the clicker. I don't know.
I'll tell you more about clickers in a minute. What I didn't know coming into this, whether everyone would already know this or not. And the answer is no. So it's okay. It's cool. And I didn't expect much this first class anyway. So this was mostly an experiment for my benefit. All right, so let's get back to that. So, I honestly have absolutely no idea what that graph is. But apparently, apparently it's been happening since 2004, and getting more and more each year. At least in Region 2. Okay. All right, anyway. So let me tell you a little bit about me. I actually know some about you already because the registrar sent me all sorts of stuff, including some of your pictures, which I thought was very strange. So anyway, here's a picture of me so that we're even. I got my PhD in 1996. My thesis topic was algorithms for sequential decision making, which is in the artificial intelligence area, and I'm still doing research in that now. I was a professor at Duke for a couple years, 96 to 99. I came back to New Jersey because, you know, New Jersey, and worked at AT&T for a couple years. And since 2002, I've been at Rutgers. My research lab with my graduate students, we're doing research. We call it the Rutgers Laboratory for Real Life Reinforcement Learning, or RL-cubed. And so that's the kind of stuff that I do, try to get computers and, in this case, robots, to learn how to do stuff from experience. Keeps me entertained. Let me tell you about the course. You probably actually don't care so much about me, but you may care a bit more about the course. So from my perspective, what I hope this course is going to do is introduce you to some cool facts, cool ideas, stuff about computer science that makes computer science really fun and exciting. Why do we bother doing this day after day? It's because we just find it really, really neat. And I think some of those really neat ideas are easy to understand even if you don't have an intense background in math or computer science, because they're just plain neat ideas. So what I'd like to do is try to introduce one or two of these per lecture. I'll kind of sprinkle them in and give you something substantive that you can hang on to and have something to take home and carry on into your life, even if you don't go into computer science, which probably most of you will not. One of the things I'd like to do is dispel the idea that some people have, obviously not you, you know, attractive and well-educated people, but some people, say like my parents, don't understand how it is that I've been studying computer science since I was a teenager, and I actually can't help them do anything in Windows. Like, isn't that what computer science is? And the answer is no. I mean, it's obviously an offshoot of computer science. It's obviously very significant, had a big impact on our culture, but it's not like, you know, Windows XP equals computer science. There's a whole lot of difference there. And so, if it's not about it, then what else is there? And that's what I want to tell you about, the stuff that's basically not Windows. So if you were hoping to learn, you know, cool tricks on how to use PowerPoint and stuff, yeah, this might not be where you went. Everybody gets up and walks out. All right. So where does this class actually fit? So here's a quick introduction to introductory classes in computer science. These specifically courses that have as the target audience undergrads, as a first, possibly only computer science course. There's a bunch of different courses out there. They teach in different ways different things. And I want to give you a sense of where this course is supposed to fit in. So we have one course on the books at Rutgers called Seminar in Computers and Society, which is really focused on the idea of what impact have computers had on the world. So, you know, there are people in the world, there are computers on the world, how have they impacted one another in various ways? Another one, Introduction to Computer Science, is more about learning to program. How do I create my own software? How do you actually tell a computer what to do so they can make a video game or organize, guest lists or run a better slideshow, whatever it is you're going to do. People have to write those programs. They don't write themselves, at least not until I get my learning lab to get that to work for everybody. But in the meantime, we really need human beings to actually do this. And as a first course, Introduction to Computer Science usually covers that material. There's another course called Introduction to Computers and Their Application, which is more what do I need to know about computing technology. This is more like how do I do cool things in PowerPoint. There's other stuff in there as well. But this is more focused on computers that are around right now, things you can do. This is how you write software. This is how the more humanities angle on computer science. None of these are what I'm talking about. So my goal for this course is to be able to answer a couple questions. One is, what is computer science? Why is it fun and or interesting? How is it different from software engineering? How is it different from creating programs? Now, this is a point that if you guys can get this by the end of the semester, I'll be ecstatic, because there are plenty of professors here at Rutgers who just don't get this. If we're on doing collaborative research together, a computer science professor and a biology professor, they will often look at us as software engineers, people who are going to help them create whatever it is, software that they want to create. And, you know, maybe we can help them with that, maybe we can't, but it's sort of... you know, using an English major or an English professor as a spell checker. That's not quite fair, because software engineering is a tremendously important and tremendously difficult, but it's kind of not exactly what we do. What are the insights that make computer science its own academic discipline? What is it that we're actually studying? Right? It's not like there was no computer science until Dell came into existence, right? So what the heck were we doing before everybody had computers? And it turns out that a lot of the really cool ideas pre-exist the you know, modern wave of PCs. So kind of wrapping your head around that, I'd be really excited if you could get to that point. All right, so some more of the details. So the textbook that I assigned for the class is this book called The Pattern on the Stone, written by Danny Hillis. It's not too daunting. It's also not too detailed. But I do find it really inspiring and informative. So basically, it's this thin little volume. I think it's like $12 on Amazon. It's a good read, and it's written. The author's personality comes out very strongly in the text. Basically, here's a guy that you can tell is just jazzed about this stuff. And so it doesn't have the kind of classical textbooky feel where it's all been, you know, the edges have all been worn off and it's nice and dry and just here are the facts and now you've got the facts. This is more, you can really tell that this guy is very excited about what he's talking about. And I thought that would be a really valuable thing to read about. Well, what is it that gets people jazzed about this stuff? So my goal is to have you read the book and to basically help as a tour guide of that book by adding more meat, more content, more stuff to think about, more details to the skeleton that he creates in the book. We're also going to be experimenting with clickers, which we had one question so far on what the hell are you talking about. So here's the deal. Let's see if I can demonstrate. So as I understand it, you had one of them. Can you hold it up for a second? Because it looks like it's the same as mine. Oh, yours is prettier than mine. I've got a stupid-looking blue one. Yours look like little mini piano keyboards. Actually, it looks like the picture. though big. So they should be available at several different bookstores, in Rutgers bookstore, but also I'm told that there's another bookstore that a lot of people go to because they have slightly better deals. My understanding is they also have better deals on these, so feel free to check that out. There's a professor, these were pushed pretty hard by a professor in, I think, economics, and he worked pretty hard with some of the local bookstores to try to get them to give people a break on it. So I think it's about the same price as the book. It might be a bit more expensive than the book, and in some ways less useful than the book, but I don't know any other way of getting this technology in your hands at this stage. At the end of the class, you can keep them. You know, they make lovely bow ties, I don't know. You can keep them. My understanding, it is the most popular clicker at Rutgers and will probably grow in popularity over the next few years, so you may find use for it in another class. If not, I believe you can sell them back to the bookstore. The professor in economics has a buyback program where he'll actually buy clickers from students. He's trying as hard as he can to just make this as easy on everybody as possible. My goal for these things is to use them for attendance, so to find out who's actually coming to class, and also for reading comprehension quizzes and straw polls. So we'll do a couple straw polls today, but obviously you don't have most of you don't have the technology. We'll just do by show of hands. For reading comprehension, so I'm going to assign readings from the book. Again, it's a very thin book. You should be able to read through it. And I'll just ask a couple questions just to make sure that you're on top of it. It's not deep and technical stuff. But I got the sense from last year's class, last semester when I taught this, that it didn't seem like people had read it. And so I wanted to put a little bit of extra onus on you to make sure that happens. It's enjoyable. I don't see any good reason not to read it. And now there's a positive reason to read it because I'll actually quiz you on it and I'll be tabulating the results. What we're hoping to do, and we haven't quite figured out how to do this yet, in spite of the fact that we're computer scientists, to be able to reprogram these a bit and have interactive demos where I can pop something up on the screen that I'm trying to explain and you as a group can actually control the action in some sense. At the moment, all it really can do is do these surveys, these synchronous surveys where everybody gets one click. I'd like everybody to have multiple clicks. Play like a group game of Pong or something like that, where like A to make the paddle go up and B to make the paddle go down. Anyway, I've got big plans, I just don't know how to do anything. So stay tuned, just to try to make it all worthwhile and a little bit more fun. All right, so from a content standpoint, here's the syllabus as we've got it at point. The material for the semester is arranged into three major sections. The first section is essentially, how does a computer work? How do you actually build a computer? And we're essentially going to have enough information by the end of that to build a computer out of things you may have lying around your house if you have a very, very big house, because there's a lot of parts in a computer. But each of the parts themselves are actually really simple to understand. And so that's what I'd like to emphasize in this first section is each step is very simple and it builds on the previous step. And if you just build up enough, you actually get this very powerful device. Section two is, what do we know about computation? What is it that computers actually do? What does it mean to compute something? A lot of work was happening on this before people actually had computers. The act of computation is really a very fundamental concept, and you don't really even need computers to do it. And so I want to tell you about what that is. What does it mean to compute something? And then the third section is kind of more demo and technology oriented. What cool things can people do with computers now that we've got them? So let me give a little bit more detail about each of these. So how computers work. So as I said, computers actually consist of a sequence of easy to understand layers. Each of the layers is actually really easy to get your head around. At the top, you've got actual programming languages that people can write in to express ideas in a computer-friendly form that actually makes the computer run. At the very bottom, there are things like bits, zeros and ones, logic gates made out of sand, essentially silicon. And the computer's actual work is all done by physical components. So it really is physics all the way down at the bottom. But at the top, it's much more idea-ish, rule-oriented. So what we're going to do is go bottom-up, conceptually creating a working computer step-by-step in the process. And the book more or less proceeds the same way, so it does follow along with that. All right, second section is about computation. We know that computers compute, but what really is computation? How powerful is it? What can it do? What can't it do? Computer scientists see the world in terms of computational problems. What does that mean? How can I kind of get that idea across to you? One of the fundamental concepts in computer science is that of an algorithm, basically a recipe for accomplishing something, for accomplishing a computation. So I want to tell you what an algorithm is, why you might want to prefer one algorithm to another if both solve the same problem, and what sort of problems can we solve and how fast can we solve them. So these sorts of things end up being really important and interesting. For example, cracking security codes, cracking passwords and things like that. The only reason that we think computer passwords are secure is because we think that the act of reverse engineering the key is too hard for normal people to do with normal computers. So if it turned out that was actually an easy problem for computers to solve, then all the security systems basically are no longer secure. Has anybody seen the movie Sneakers? It's a little bit old now. Yeah, just those of us who around the block. Very cute movie, and it's actually very apropos in some ways now. I had my grad students and I watched it the beginning of the summer, and all sorts of political references that I thought were still apropos after all these years. But anyway, the crux of the movie is essentially some mathematician figures out how to do an efficient computation for cracking passwords, and basically now nothing's protected anymore to the people who have this box that implements the algorithm. And they don't really get into the algorithm. It's not really about the computer science, but the implications of that turn out to be really interesting and involve, Robert Redford, and so it's all very good. All right. Section three, useful applications, surveying how computer power is being harnessed. So this is kind of a grab bag. I may remove and insert different things into this list as we get closer, depending on which people in my department are willing to give guest lectures, for example. But I'll definitely talk about machine learning. That's my area. Things like pattern recognition. I'm hoping to get somebody to come and talk about computer graphics. Computer graphics are really big business now in terms of creating movies and creating video games. How do they do that? What is it? The question my mom asked me a lot. It's like, what does that have to do with computers? What does this animation have to do with computers? How do computers do that? Like, I'm happy to tell you, but you actually have to listen to the answer, which of course, then she goes off to this. But I'm pretty sure I can tell you guys. What is AI search? What sort of problems can you solve that are more artificial intelligence-y? I'll talk a little bit about language games if there's time. How do you get computers to play games like crossword puzzles or Trivial Pursuit, that sort of thing. I have we have a demo from last semester, a robotics demo, where we've got this cool little robot that actually rolls around on the floor. And we have sort of a tentative offer from Bloomberg, not the mayor, but his company, to actually give us, this class, a pile of these robots to play with, as long as we put donated by Bloomberg on the robot. So I'm willing to take that for the sake of giving you guys robots to play with for a little bit. So I'm going to see if I can make that work. If not, I'll at least show you we've got one of these, and I'll show you the sorts of things that it can do. Talk about genetic algorithms, getting computers to compute using ideas from evolutionary biology. And a bit about data compression. How is it that we can take information and squeeze it inside a computer? What does that even mean? And how could that even be possible? You know, computers don't get squishier on the inside. And so a lot of these have really neat ideas behind them, and they're easy to understand once you have the basics. So computers, they are everywhere. You probably knew. But it's sort of funny to think back at a time when they weren't everywhere. In 1977, a very well-known technologist who was actually creating computers at the time was quoted as saying, "There's no reason for any individual to have a computer in his home, or in her home." That's just so unimaginable now. Of course, we have. Not only do we have computers in our homes, but we have computers on our person almost all the time. Things like cell phones and personal digital assistants like Palm Pilots, things like that. Certainly computers at home, laptop computers, video games are just computers that are programmed to do some specific things. Digital cameras now are effectively computers that are pre-programmed and have a lens on them. So that turned out to be just really wrong. So let me do a quick survey. We would do it with the clickers if we have more clickers. But how many computers do you have with you right now? So here's what I'm counting as a computer. Certainly a laptop. I see two laptops at least, and they're Macs. Handheld game system. You don't have to tell me if you have it, but if you have, just tell me that you have something. Cell phones are computers. A GPS device if you get lost a lot. I don't know that anybody actually carries these. PDA, MP3 player is a computer. It's all just computers on the inside. So, all right. So here's how I'd like to do that. Since we don't have clickers going yet. So, who has zero computers?
Whoa.
Okay, so zero. Who has one computer with them? Okay, all right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And a chin pincher. Okay. What did I say, 11? Okay. Two computers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Wow. How many do I have? I have my laptop and my cell phone. No, I think just two. So I'll be on this list as well. Anybody have three? Nice. All right. Anybody have more than three? All right. So how many computers is that altogether? First of all, that's 25 people, which is fewer than are registered for the class, unfortunately. And how do we compute the total number fast? Well, we do 1 times 11, 0 times 0, 2 times 13, and 3 times 1, and we add these guys together. So what? So 7, here are the 1. So 40 computers, 25 people. It's like what? It's like 8 over 5 or 16 over 10. So like 1.6 per person. That's pretty cool. Alright, so they really are everywhere. So be careful, don't offend them. They may rise up against us. Alright, so not only are there lots of things that we have access to now, but there are some things that we couldn't even imagine trying to do years ago that are now, some of them are very commonplace. This is the lion from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Witch and the Wardrobe not shown. And this is all created on a computer. This lion didn't exist. And the kid actors interact with it, and they put their fingers through its mane, and it doesn't exist. It's not there. It's all been drawn by computer to look like a real lion. And it's one of the best examples that I've seen. I mean, they had to actually have the computers draw the individual hairs on the mane of the lion to really get this to look not distracting. really make it look like it's there in the scene. They also have to do all sorts of subtle things about making sure that the way that the light falls in the scene falls the same way in the rendering, in the computer drawing of the lion, because if the lion is always the same illumination as they walk under a shadow or something like that, it'll just stand out as just looking completely wrong. Do you know how many computers you have with you? Just so I can put you in a survey. No. We'll talk about it later. All right, so this is pretty cool, and people have been doing animation for decades and decades and decades, but the idea that you'd be able to render something with this level of photorealism was just, I don't think anybody even thought about it. Who uses Google? Google is so cool. And there are other search engines. I don't want to make it sound like, Google doesn't give me any money or anything. They'll occasionally give me t-shirts if I ask. But this sort of thing where you could just sit down at your computer and you can ask any question at any time and get something back. I mean, you can stump it, but goodness, I mean, the amount of information you have access to now is just inconceivable. I mean, when Google was first getting started, the idea that somebody was going to collect all this data into one place, I don't think anybody believed that was possible. They've got more computers than probably anybody else. I'm going to talk a little bit about computer graphics in one of the lectures, but the technology underlying Google is so core computer science that I'm going to spend a couple lectures talking about different aspects of how Google does what it does. It's just remarkable, and it just touches a lot of really neat ideas. This maybe is not so commonplace. This is like robots doing surgery on people. I don't think that the computer is actually doing the surgery. I don't think there's a program that's actually deciding, you know, what to cut and so forth. But I'm pretty sure that, well, you know, when you grab random images off the web, you don't really know. This could be some faked scene for all I know. But my belief is that one of these robot arms is actually controlling a camera, and there's some actual surgeon someplace off, possibly in another state, who is instructing those robot arms where to turn, how to move, when to snip, how deep to go, and so forth, and, you know, possibly saving this person's life, or at least making him look really silly on this picture. Another thing is GPS. I don't know if people have spent a lot of time playing with GPS. They're getting much more commonplace in, like, rental cars, and some people actually buy cool devices that they actually put in their cars to help with directions and so forth. But what these things are actually doing is they're listening to signals from a network of satellites that the U.S. government has put all around the entire world, and using that to figure out precisely where on the surface of the Earth they are, both location-wise and also altitude-wise, if they can get access to enough satellites. That whole process of taking those signals and turning it into a place, and then figuring out, oh, that means you must be on Route 9 heading north. If you're trying to get to Rutgers, you need to go here and 2 miles turn left, et cetera, et cetera. That's all computation, right? Computer science is not about putting the satellites into orbit necessarily, but once they're there, using that information to create something that's useful for people, that's pretty cool computation. And so, and again, I can't imagine that people, before this was a reality, could even imagine, oh, at some point we're going to have satellites all around the atmosphere and telling us where we are all the time because it's so important. There was a time when people couldn't even imagine wanting to know what time it was all the time, let alone exactly where you are. So. Anyway, so a lot of these things are really neat. Now, this is a demo that I... Okay. See if I can do this demo. I guess the speakers are working. I don't want to make it too loud, because I want to give my own voiceover as it goes. It's very dramatic. All right, so did anybody see the new Superman movie? Cool. All right, did anybody see the old Superman movie? Oh, good. All right, very good. I saw that. So this is Marlon Brando. He actually died 2 years ago. Very famous actor in lots of great movies. He was in the earlier Superman movie as Superman's dad, and they wanted him to be in the new Superman movie as Superman's dad, who had died. Superman's dad had died, but Marlon Brando unfortunately had died, so it's a weird kind of typecasting, I guess. So they had to figure out some way of bringing him back for the purposes of the movie. So I think the video got a little bit ahead of me. Can I pause it? I don't think I can.
I don't think anything can bring back my hairstyle.
No, well, that was the 80s, you know. We're all sorry about that. So what they did is they had plenty of clips of him talking in makeup for the other movie, but he wasn't saying the right lines because they hadn't been written yet. So somehow, I don't know if somebody did his voice or they synthesized his voice, but in this particular video, what they're doing is they're saying, there's a clip of him saying, you don't remember me, because, you know, I'm dead and I sent you away when you were a baby. And they wanted him to, they wanted Marlon Brando to say that. So they went looking through lots and lots of clips of places where facially he was more or less acting the right way, but his lips were saying the wrong thing. So they grabbed that clip and they blotted out of his mouth. So you can't see what he's actually saying because it's not what they want him to say. They want him to say, you don't remember me. Then they actually build computer models, 3D computer models of a head, and they morph it. They subtly change it so that it matches exactly the face that they recorded. And then they actually get it to animate along with the face. And that requires a lot of guesswork, right? Because this is 3D information and they're extracting it from a 2D image. But we know a little bit about how heads are shaped, so it's not as hard as it sounds. Then they went through a process of actually adding coloring to it so that it looked much more natural. And they could do things like take the actual photograph and wrap it around the model, the face, and then fix it up on the edges, and then use the same kind of skin textures that they have on other parts of the face to add texture to a fake mouth that they're now animating, right, in the computer model, so that the lips move along with the dialogue that they actually wanted. Okay. Now, of course, it still looks pretty fake because the teeth are glowing. The teeth aren't lit right. So then they have to go through and touch that up. And a lot of this is just done by hand. That's not the computers are doing all of this. It's the computers are the tool that are allowing the people to actually accomplish all of this. So the eyebrow movements, the head shape, that's all real Brando, or at least inspired by Brando. But then the lips are fake. And there he is saying it. So now, not only do they have him saying the wrong words, or the words that they wanted, but not the words that he actually said, but they actually have a 3D model of his head doing that. So now you can actually look at it from angles that are different from when the movie was originally, or the clip anyway, was originally recorded. You can actually now scan around and see him saying it from the side. So, like that. Including the eye blinking and the... then ultimately, this is a little creepy. That's the inside-out face, which our eyes perceive as the right side of the face backwards. Anyway, now that they have this 3D model, they can combine it with other computer graphics techniques and make it look like he's in an ice crystal, and then make it look like he's actually talking to Superman, or Superman B, Kyle, whatever his name is, and actually show it in the scene with the camera panning around the ice crystal and the face moving in what would be more or less an appropriate way for a 3D hologram in an ice sculpture, we assume. So there you go. So here's this thing that they probably should have never done in the first place, but it's made possible by this computer technology that now exists. Tremendously powerful computers needed to do this because they're actually drawing each of those dots in every frame of the movie, which consists of a series of very clearly displayed frames. So I don't know. I thought that would be a neat example of what some people are doing with computer graphics. I wanted to get the stuff about the lion, but I couldn't find any good clips. Just there's clips of the lion doing its thing, but it doesn't show you how they actually accomplished that. All right, so what ties all these ideas together? What makes computer science a somewhat coherent whole? And I would say, I sat down and I thought, and I kept boiling it down, and I finally got it down to one word, and I think this is the right word. If I had to summarize the intellectual contribution of computer science in one word, it would be reduction. Probably not the word you thought of. But there's a really good reason for this. The way that most things progress in computer science, and we're going to see lots of examples of this, is problems that are posed and then solved by reducing them to other problems. So computer scientists will often figure out what is it that you're actually trying to do. Call that a problem. To find a different problem that might be easier to solve and figure out how to map one to the other. And then actually they'll keep doing this until it's a problem that we know how to solve really easily. And so this notion of taking problems and converting them to other problems is just everywhere in computer science. And it's not something, I don't think it's something that you notice unless you actually look for it. So I'll be pointing it out as we go. It brings to mind, to me, this joke about turtles all the way down. Do people familiar with that joke? Whenever I tell, again, the experienced computer scientist, whenever I try to tell a joke, like a prepackaged joke, I mean, my impromptu jokes haven't been so funny today, it seems, from this group. But whenever I try to tell a joke, it never, ever works. So here goes with that as an intro. So, I don't even know how it starts. Some famous physicist, we'll call him Einstein because he's famous, gives a public lecture and is explaining about space-time and the extent of the universe. And a kindly woman comes up to him after the lecture and says, you were obviously very articulate, you were a great speaker, it was really nice to hear how much you thought about this problem, but here's the thing, you're wrong about the way the universe works. The universe, especially the Earth, is actually held up by a giant turtle. And I know this to be true. And so the physicist says, that's interesting that you think that, but let me ask you this question. If the world is perched on the back of the turtle, then what's holding the turtle up? That's a very good question. It's another turtle. Okay, well, what's holding up that turtle? Oh, okay, now you're way too clever for me, but you should know it's turtles all the way down. As I said, these jokes just never ever work. But anyway, the point is that, again, you're taking the turtle problem and reducing it to, how does the Earth stay up? Well, it stays up on a turtle, but you still have to solve the problem of how the turtle stays up. It's just more turtles. Well, and that's computer science. Anyway, I should just stop trying, and yet I was like irresistible force pulling me to make a fool out of myself. All right, so lots of different ideas in computer science actually have this notion of complexity built on top of less complexity or simplicity. Computer networks, we're all very familiar with computer networks transmitting information from one place to another, getting computers to talk to each other. It turns out to be a very complicated thing to get them to do this, to get them to actually reliably communicate information back and forth. And over the years, people have structured this process into a series of layers. There's the physical layer of the wires actually touching each other. Built on top of that, there's what's called the data link layer, in which very primitive information is exchanged. On top of that is a network layer, where the system can actually reason about transmitting information not just from one place to another, but from one place to any other place. On top of that, the transport layer, actually gathering up the data that you want and pushing it through the network, session, so that you're actually, these connections actually have some kind of semantics to them, presentation, and ultimately application, the things that you're really doing with the network. And each layer is built very cleanly on top of the layer underneath, so that the people responsible for creating, say, the transport layer, can really focus on their task, making that work as well as possible. And they can assume that everybody underneath of them has done their job, so they can use that in building what they create. And what they then provide to the higher layers is some particular kind of functionality. And this idea of just breaking the levels of functionality down into lower and lower levels is what enables these complicated entities to actually be created. People trying to understand how human vision works have also broken things down into layers. We're going to talk about, in the context of computing, this notion of the physical bits that build logic gates, that build logic blocks, that build machine languages, that build high-level languages, and ultimately programs, the kind of programs that you actually run. Computer storage is actually also built in a hierarchy like this. So at the very lowest level, the processor that's actually doing all the work here is keeping information temporarily in what's called registers, those tiny little places to hold information. There's not very many of them, so extra information ends up being in a nearby cache, fast, but somewhat not as fast source of data. Out from there is the RAM. People know about that to some extent, the memory storage that your computer has. Even bigger than that is the disk. You can actually store additional information just on the disk drive, the hard disk, for example. And then even more than that, you can actually have a rack, like a closet that you just keep lots of disks in. So each level is storing more information, but it's harder to get to. It's harder for the processor to actually use that information, much slower. And so there's this kind of inherent trade-off that happens. So this is another example of where that actually gets you. All right, so what am I going to do today? So I'll start off talking about the textbook next time. I assume that you don't have it yet, you don't have access to it. And what I'll do in that lecture is introduce bits and some simple logic gates, the very most primitive level of where computation is happening in your computers. So please read the preface in chapter 1, section 1. But since you don't have the book, I'd still like to give you something to kind of think about and chew on. So here's the plan. Oh, I should say, by the way, that until I figure out how to actually use the official Rutgers website that you can all access, I just have my own off of my homepage. A webpage for the course. On that webpage, there's information like where the room is, which I'm going to say you already know. Also has information like my email address if you need to write to me for any reason. We have two very, very capable graduate students who are helping out with the class. There's Monica Babesh, who's there in the middle, and there's John Hasman, who's in the back, who until somewhat recently was the rector's undergrad, so he knows more about how undergrad things work than I do. So I'm really glad that they're going to be helping out. Their email addresses are on the website. You can find them there. You can also find the list of all the lectures and last year's version of all the lectures, except for lecture one, which you can get this year's version of, because it's done. So if you ever, I'll try to make them available before class, so you can actually go there and download PDF files and print them if you want to bring notes to class to take notes on. You're welcome to do so. If you have, some people have laptops, you can browse them online there. So there's lots of different ways to do this. All right, but what I would like to do today is actually give you a choice about what I will talk about for the rest of the class. Let me see. 4 o'clock, and we're done at 4:30. That's not right. 4:40. Oh, good. Okay. Yes. I would Google my name, Michael Littman, and then it's the first link on my page, I think, or maybe the second one. But it's I'll write it down for you. UPC barcodes work. Now UPC barcodes are the little they're the little stripes that are on products when you buy them in the store. The thing that goes beep when the cashier brings them up. Right? Turns out there's actually a hierarchy of codes. It gives a good example of production. Charles Babbage was a computer pioneer in the 1800s before electronic computing devices actually existed. But he actually came up with a really neat idea for a mechanical machine that could do certain kinds of computation. It was eventually built in the London Science Museum, and apparently actually works according to his specifications, though he died long before he got a chance to see it. And the kind of the concept here is this notion that you can do, it's a very simple way of doing computations for what end up being fairly complicated numerical sequences. So, all right, so think about what you're about to hear about. And if it's the difference engine, raise your hand. And if it's, don't look at each other, because they don't know what you want. If it's UPC barcodes, put up your hand. Okay, that's more or less what I figured. So sorry, I know that I can see you on your face, you're like, UPC barcodes, that's just dumb. But the notes do, the notes for the difference engine are all in the notes. So, who knows, maybe I won't be able to bear not having told you, and I'll do it some other time. But what I'm going to do now is UPC barcodes. All right. This is what you're missing. Actually, if you're not, you're missing it too slowly. Let me jump ahead. If I were a better slide hacker, I would have made a jump to it. Well, I'm going to totally draw. This is Keynote, by the way. This is the Max version of PowerPoint. Okay, all right, good. We're good to go. So barcode. So there's nothing about this in the book. I don't know if I have any books to talk about it. But, Wikipedia is actually pretty cool. So I learned about this first at Wikipedia, and then I went to other places. I presume that you savvy people already know what Wikipedia is. If you do not, feel free to visit the Wikipedia website and browse around. It's an encyclopedia that has, you know, longer entries on Stephen Colbert than it does on, you know, John Henry from the Revolutionary War. But nevertheless, it's still pretty cool, and it has lots of, it has the stuff that people are thinking about right now in it. And it turns out barcodes is one of those things. So what can I tell you about barcodes? It turns out there's many, many different styles of barcodes. The most common that you run across in your daily life is what's called UPC-A. It's in use in most North American retail stores and has been extended somewhat to be used in throughout Europe and I believe in Asia as well. But I think it doesn't have quite the same rules of what I'm going to describe. So I'm going to focus mostly on UPC-A, UPC encoding. Many of the same ideas, though. I mean, if you kind of get the general gist of this, the same kind of gist applies to a bunch of other things. Like in the US, all checks, if you write a check, at the bottom there'd be a routing number. It looks kind of like this information. There's all sorts of rules that decide how they lay these out and what information they contain. And they're different from the UPC barcodes, but it has the same basic skeleton. So you'll have a sense of how that works as well. You may wonder why the numbers on your checks are so weirdly shaped. They're actually very carefully designed to be easy to be read by a computer. Not as easy as barcodes, but easier than just normal printed digits. There's also these things called photostamps now. I don't know if anyone's experimented with these. I've seen them advertised. But they're basically, you can print your own US postage stamps. The information that encodes that this is a valid stamp is all in terms of little rectangular blocks, so essentially barcodes. And then you can put any photo you want, like, you know, on the stamp, and then put it on an envelope and mail. So that's pretty cool. I don't know exactly how they do that. How do they verify that, you know, you didn't just print the same stamp 100 times and built the post office out of money? Presumably, each of these has a unique code that they can verify hasn't been already used. Infrared remotes, like universal remotes when you control VCRs or DVD players or whatever, they also have a code system that they use to transmit information to the products to tell them to change channels and so forth. It has a similar kind of feel to it. Luggage routing barcodes are used so that they can lose your luggage more efficiently. RFIDs are not so common yet, but they may become common any day now. These are radio frequency IDs. These are little tags that they can print onto products so that electronic wireless sensors can actually know that they're there. Basically, a product like tubes of toothpaste are just sitting there all the time saying, I'm a tube of toothpaste. And then there's sensors that you can actually use to detect that. And then if somebody wants to buy the tube of toothpaste, you hear the tube of toothpaste leaving the store, and you can, you know, take it and charge them. I don't know what people really do with these, to be honest. But again, it involves codes. All right, but I'm going to talk about the code that I've read the most about, the universal product codes. The first scan product happened more than 30 years ago, and it was a pack of Wrigley's gum. Not gun. Sorry. Gum. And in fact, Wikipedia, in its wisdom, has two different dates that they give for when this happened, because, you know, it is Wikipedia. Nevertheless, they both agreed that it did happen in 1974. One of them thought it happened on April 1st, which I thought was kind of funny, but then another one thought it was April 20-something. So, you know, April Fool's on me. But what UPC codes are is a method for identifying products at the point of sale, like at the checkout register, essentially by 11-digit numbers. They're also a method of encoding digit sequences so they can be read quickly and easily by the machine. Usually computers fitted with some kind of laser scanner or something else like that. You can see this is an example of a UPC code being read. You can see the red laser stripe going across it. Notice that the laser stripe doesn't even really have to be exactly even with anything. The product can be at an angle. It all gets worked out because this is just so simple. The data is encoded in such a simple way. All right, so what I want to do is unpack this level by level. So I want to say that this is actually an example of this reduction idea. Each level of representation of a UPC barcode uses an encoding, uses some way of representing that information in the next level. So let me go from the bottom up. At the very bottom, and I have my Pond's dry skin cream here as my visual aid. So on the actual label, you've got little ink patterns. So at the lowest level, it's ink. It's actually physical ink in the real world. And it's not information or ideas. It's, you know, it's just a sticker on the side of the Pond. I guess Ponky wouldn't be very useful for Pond. this pattern of ink actually encodes a sequence of 95 zeros and ones, exactly 95 zeros and ones, reading across the code. Those 95 zeros and ones actually encode a sequence of 12 digits, normal decimal digits, like 0 through 9 digits. Those 12 digits actually encode just a sequence of 11 digits. One of the digits turns out to be extra just for error checking. And these 11 digits actually encode the name of the retail product. So in this particular case, it's Pond Dry Skin Cream, net weight 3.9 ounces. So this particular product, so they know what it is that the checkout person is just scanning. So I want to go through these now top down, level by level, and show how each level uses the level underneath to represent it. All right, so this is the Pond's Dry Skin Cream. All right. It's manufactured by Unilever Home and Personal Care USA. It doesn't actually say that anywhere on the label. It actually says, and this is where my age is starting to become a problem, it says Cheeseboro Ponds USA, Greenwich, Connecticut. But I happen to know from the barcode that this is actually manufactured by Unilever Home and Personal Care USA. Here's another example. I think I have this in my bag as well. A little bit less personal. I just found this on my desk, and it's Avery labels, little like "Hello, my name is" labels, name badge labels with their size. There's 100 labels in the pack, manufactured or distributed by Avery Dennison and the Avery Division. All right, so these are two different products. They each have their own barcode. So that's essentially what you want to encode, but it doesn't say that anywhere here that a computer can make any sense out of. So we need another level of representation. So what we're going to do is we're going to associate with each product an 11-digit number. Now, you know, digit, and I'm going to sometimes say decimal digit. I know that confused some people last semester because they thought decimal meant like decimal point. But decimal, I just mean numbers 0 through 9, base 10. So the 11-digit number is a sequence of 11 digits. How many different items can 11 digits encode? How many digits can, if you had clickers, you would be able to tell me what you thought. We can vote on this anyway. So you've got 11 digits. Each one can be 0 through 9. How many different combinations can you actually create with that? It's more than 11. It could be, this is what, 10 billion? It could be 100 billion. It could be 10 billion minus 1. It could be 20 billion minus 1. So who thinks, so the clickers are more fun because you're not tempted to look over each other's shoulders. But who thinks A? Not so much on A. B? Okay. We've got half on B, C, fifth on that, and D. And that's not adding up to one, so some of you just decided not to say anything about it. All right, it turns out the answer in this case is B, which was the majority answer in the class. And why is this so? It's because, well, think about just one digit. How many different numbers can you represent with one digit? Well, there's 10 of them. There's 1 through 9 and 0, that's 10 of them. So one digit gets you 10, which is a 1 with 1 0. Two digits gets you everything from 00 to 99, which is 100 different numbers. That's one with two zeros in it. So if you've got 11 digits, you should be able to represent, I mean, now I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think you can follow, the number of combinations should be one with 11 zeros after it, which is this guy. Okay? So that's actually, not all these are in use. That's a lot of different possible products. So that's why, even though this started in 30 years ago using these codes, they haven't really run out yet. There's still plenty of spare numbers to go around. It turns out there's actually websites where you can buy barcode numbers. I didn't know this until yesterday. There's a whole seamy underworld of barcode salesmanship that goes on. And like, if you want to manufacture a product and you want the stores to be able to scan your product, you need a barcode. You know, you got to go to the guy with the trench coat, you know, want to buy a barcode. And you pay people actual money, a lot of money too, it's like hundreds of dollars, for them just to give you your own 11-digit number. So how do they encode the name of the product using an 11-digit number? It turns out it's done in blocks. The first six digits are identify the manufacturer. Whose product is this? And the first of those six digits actually tells you about the product category. So 0, 1, 6, 7, 8, or 9 just means a product. I don't think that there's any more semantics to it than that. If it starts with 2, it's actually a little bit more interesting. Products that start with 2 are actually belong to the store where they're being sold. They can use it for whatever they want, and they usually use it for variable weight items. So I didn't bring this in for reasons that you'll understand in a second. in my fridge there's Land O'Lakes American cheese. And there's a barcode on that, and encoded on the barcode, somehow, it starts with a 2, because I bought it at the deli counter, right? They chopped up the cheese for me. Starts with a 2, then there's a couple numbers that probably mean Land O'Lakes white American cheese, and then the actual price is visible on the label, if you know where to look for it. The last 3 digits were like $6.60, which is how much we bought in cheese. So, it's something, you know, if you're actually in the store, look at that. You can actually see it's either going to be the weight or the price. The price per pound times a pound as part of the actual barcode. That way, when you take it up to the front of the store and you go to pay for it, they scan it in, they're like, oh, I don't have to weigh this for you. It's already encoded in that digit sequence. So that's if it starts with a 2. If it starts with a 3, then it's actually a drug or pharmaceutical product, and the number, the rest of the number, actually encodes the national drug code. So apparently there's a whole other sequence of numbers that are assigned by the federal government for not controlled substances, but like substances that have, that are FDA-ish. I actually don't know. For example, this Pond's dry skincare does start with a 3, but I actually couldn't find this number in their database. I'm not sure I really believe this claim. But nevertheless, according to the Wikipedia, if it starts with a 3, the rest of it encodes what drug it is. That's the first 6 digits. The next 5 digits, the last 5 digits, that's not actually, oh, the last 5 digits of the 11. Is a manufacturer-assigned ID number. So once you as a manufacturer have your own special magic code for the first 6 digits, then you're allowed to do whatever you want with the last 5 digits. So you can number all your products however you want. Presumably you send that data to the stores so that when they scan your product, they know what it is that they've scanned. And I found a website that has a lot of products. It had these 2, my labels and my dry skin cream, but it didn't have a whole bunch of other stuff that I had lying around on my desk. So it's not comprehensive. I don't know how they keep this sort of thing up to date. Because the last 5, there's I don't think there is any centralized place where all these last 5 digits are known. You actually have to go to the manufacturer to find that out. There is an organization that keeps the organization codes, though. All right, anyway, so here are some concrete examples. The labels, my little Avery labels here. Here's the barcode. The first 11 digits are this. The leading 0 means it's just a general product. The 72782 actually says, this is Avery, this is from Avery. I found that in the database, and it was like, wait a second, and it's on my desk. How did they know? And last 5 digits are actually Avery's code that they assigned to this particular product. There's a whole bunch in the database, there's a bunch of other Avery label products, like, what if there's not 100 labels in a package, it's some other number, they give that a different code. The Pond's dry skin cream. Here's what the barcode says on it. These are the numbers on it. 3 means it's a drug. This code here means it's from Unilever. That's how I knew who actually makes this, in case you care. And the last 5 digits presumably are from the National Drug Code repository, but I couldn't find it there. So for all I know, this is, you know, contraband skin cream. So that's an 11-digit number, but actually on the barcode, if you look at it, there are 12 digits. So what's going on there? So the UPC folks decided to include another digit, 11 digits for the product and then 1 extra digit. Why? Here's why. So here's, I used this database to find a couple examples that I particularly like. These are product codes for lime juice, hot dogs, Reese's peanut butter, chocolate egg, I like these more than the other guys, and bumblebee salmon. All of the codes for all the 11-digit codes for these products are identical, except for the second digit, which is part of the manufacturer code. Because this is Reese's or Hershey, probably this is Bumblebee, and so forth. So if you just say you misread or mistype this digit, what could happen? You misread digit 2, and what you thought you were buying, which was chocolate eggs, turns out to be, you know, salmon. Or even worse, lime juice. If you eat lime juice thinking that it's a peanut butter cup, you're going to be very sad. So they didn't want this to happen. They didn't want one tiny little typographical error to get you the wrong product. So what they do is they add what's called a check digit. And here's how the check digit is computed. This is the last digit on UPC code. You add the digits in the odd number of positions. Take the 11 digits, add up all the ones that are in the odd positions, and multiply the sum by 3. Do not make this up. I don't know why they made it up this way. Then add to that the sum of all the digits that are in the even positions, the second digit, the fourth digit, the sixth digit. When you're done with all that, subtract the result from the next higher multiple of 10, or if it already is a multiple of 10, it's 0. That result is a single digit, and it's the check digit. It's the digit that appears at the very, very end. So, back to this example. Here is, this is the lime juice code. Here's a little bit of computer code in the language called Python that we're going to be using as just for examples in the class. Step one, so it's, here's the, you take the 11 digits as input. Step one is you add those digits together and multiply the result by 3. Step two is you take whatever you got in step one and add all the even position digits to it. And the last step, this is just a little bit of tricky code that I wrote that does what it said before, which is how much space is there from where you are to the sum that you got to the next multiple of 10. And that's the check digit. So if that's your 11-digit code, first thing you have to do is separate out the even digits, the even position digits and the odd ones. So I colored the red ones on the even position digits, and the gray ones are the odd position digits. We can then add up the odd digits. The digits that are in the odd positions, they add up to 6. The digits that are in the even positions, they add up to 14. You take 3 times 6 plus 14, you get 32. How far is that from the next multiple of 10? What is the next multiple of 10 after 32? Multiple of 10 would be a number that has a 0 in the last position. 40? Yeah, which was just my most recent birthday, and I'm pretty sad about that. All right, so we subtract 32 from 40, we get 8, and that's the check digit that appears if I happen to have lime juice with me from that manufacturer. That would be the last digit of the barcode. So the lime juice gets an 8 at the end, the francs get a 5 at the end, the chocolate egg gets a 4 at the end, the salmon gets a 1 at the end. Now, no two of these are one digit apart. The only way that you can mistake a chocolate egg for a jar of lime juice is if you make 2 mistakes. One mistake is not enough. One mistake, and you would notice that something was wrong, the digits don't match. And the scanners will do that. If they misread one of the digits, and the check sum, this check digit doesn't work, it'll say, you know, beep or something and say, scan that again. Alright? Cute. Very good. It's a very clever little trick. And it only costs you 1 extra digit. Alright. And so then, yeah, all are. The closest that 2 codes can be is 2 digits apart, not 1 digit apart. All right, so now we've got a 12-digit number. Now what do we do next? We turn them into bits. Here's how we turn them into bits. We've got 12 digits. That's 6 digits and 6 digits. We actually separate them out into 2 blocks. And then we write out the following sequence. 1, 0, 1, and then we encode the first 6 digits. Then 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. Then we encode the second 6 digits inverted. And then 101. So let me break that down a little more closely. Each digit, so like the 8 that's at the end of the lime juice, that's the number 8. We have to turn that into a code, a pattern of zeros and ones. And it's going to be encoded using 7 bits, 7 zeros and ones. And here's what they are. So 8 is represented by the pattern 011011. These codes were assigned according to 3 rules. They're somewhat arbitrary, but they satisfy three properties. One is they're as different as possible. They're more than 1 bit apart. Each one starts with a 0 and ends with a 1. You can see that's true. If reading from left to right, they switch from 0 to 1, back to 0, and then to 1. So they do that switch twice. So for example, 0, 0, 0, now we switch to 1, 1, switch back to 0, we switch back to 1. They all do that. They all go some number of zeros, some number of ones, some number of zeros, some number of ones. Furthermore, consecutively, you can't have more than 4 of the same bit in a row. So, for example, the code for 7, oh, sorry, the code for 3 has 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1. 4 ones in a row, but you can't have 5 ones in a row, you can't have 5 zeros in a row. That's against the rules that these people made up. So, given those rules, they made up codes for each of the different digits. And now, when we go to take our 12-digit number and encode it in bits, we write 101, then whatever the first digit is, we encode that as a 7-digit pattern, 7-bit pattern. Then the B, the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, the sixth one. Then we use this intermediate pattern, 01010. Then we do the next 6 digits, but now we change all the zeros to ones and all the ones to zeros. There's possibly a good reason for that, though I couldn't quite see it. But nevertheless, that's what they do. But this is all very simple and mechanical, if somewhat kind of annoying. So how many bits does this make altogether? So we've got 3, 3 bits in the front, 5 bits in the middle, 3 bits at the end, so that's 6 and 5 is 11. And then each of the 12 digits are turned into 7 bits, so 12 times 7 plus 11, which is 95. Okay, so choice B. All right, so now we've got a 95-bit pattern for pond in green. But we haven't printed our barcode yet. So here's what we do. Given the long pattern of bits, we write a 1 as a bar and a 0 as a space, right? Black bar and a 0 is just empty space, no ink. If you've got 2 ones in a row, they become a double width bar. It's like 2 skinny bars right next to each other, so it's twice as thin. 2 zeros in a row become a double wide space. You can never have more than 4 of the same bit in a row, so there's really 4 sizes that you can have. A size 1 space, a size 2 space, a size 3 space, and a size 4 space. Similarly with the bars. Notice because of the way that it was defined, it starts and ends with bars, so that there's skinny lines on both sides that mark the beginning and the end of the pattern. So here's an example. I believe this is the skin cream once again. This is the actual 12-digit code, including the 8, which is the tech check digit. It starts with 101, then it encodes the 3, the 7 bits, it encodes the rest of the manufacturer code, has a whole bunch of bits, has the middle, and then the last 6 digits get encoded as these bits, which I'm not going to read because that would be tedious. These last ones are actually in reverse. Notice that the code for 0, here's the code for 0, 0001101. After the middle bar, we encode the 0 the same way, 0001101, but we switch the 0s and the 1s. So each 0 becomes a 1, each 1 becomes a 0. So now it's 1110010. Kind of like black on white, white on black, the inverse video almost. So now, whereas the digits all started with 0 and ended with 1, the patterns, now they all start with 1 and end with 0 after the middle. I think the reason they did this, and I don't know for sure, they say so that you can read it backwards. You can read it backwards anyway. But this way, it's really easy to read backwards. It's easy to know that you're reading it backwards because the beginnings and the ends are swapped. So when you start reading it backwards, you get 1010, which makes it look like it's reading it forward. So then I don't buy that excuse. So I'm not sure. But they decided to do this, and that's the way that the codes actually work. All right, so when you have a barcode like this, you know, you have the pattern of bars, which I just explained, and then underneath of it, they write the digits. The digits are only there because otherwise we get freaked out that there's some weird code. The digits just tell you what's on the bars, and the computers don't read the digits. The computers just read the bars. So this is just, you know, for our benefit. So here's a close-up of that same pattern. This is the actual 95 bits that I worked out according to the rules. I just followed the rules as they were laid out for me. They're all, here's exactly the pattern of bits that I got for the pond skin cream. And you can see, this barcode was actually generated from a different website. It matches exactly, you know, the pattern that I've got here. So they line up perfectly. Look, 1 is a bar, 0 is a space. 1 is a bar, 0 is a space. 4 ones in a row is a 4 thick bar. Then a 0, single space. Single 1 becomes a single bar. And it just reads right off, left to right, just like that. So now, since you know how this process is done, you could, in principle, do it in reverse. I won't have you do that right now. But I should be able to, in a sense, if I gave you a barcode, you could actually stare at it for a long time, figure out what the bit pattern it represents, turn that back into a series of digits, and then potentially look up those digits in a database to find out, oh, it's Snapple, whatever it happens. Okay? Was that dread in your voice or anticipation? Yes, of course. I think what I'd like you to do, I'll make up something that works on the homework so that it's not too onerous. But I would like you to like find things that have barcodes on them and calculate the check digit, just kind of see what the pattern looks like. I think I find it hard by eye to distinguish a 3 space from a 4 space, and so it's actually kind of difficult to get it exactly right. The reason the computers don't have any trouble with this is they actually do, when the laser scans across, it measures the exact distances that it's seeing black and seeing white and so forth, and uses the first bar, whichever side it's scanning first, as whatever the thickness is, and then it just can divide it out. So it sees much more accurately than we do. So I would find it, I've gone through that exercise just to see how it works. And yeah, you know, I'm like 85% accurate. I do have, is this a 4 or a 3? I'm not sure. Yeah. So if you scan it upside down, you get information that if you try to interpret it forward, it's broken. Because what you see from the way that the different digits are encoded, they're not reversible. Let's see if that's actually true. So look at this 0. The 0 is 0001101. If you scan it backwards and it's inverted, it would be what? Yeah, help me out. I can't see it at the same time. It would be 0110011. Is that right? Did I do the right one? 01. No, I didn't. I did the digit 1 by accident. Sorry. The digit 0, if you read it backwards and it's on the wrong side, it'll be 0. So here's what it really is. 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. There's 3 zeros, then 2 ones, and then 1, 0, and then 1, 1. When it's on the right-hand side of the bar, it's going to be reversed, and zeros are going to be ones, and so forth. So this is going to become 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. So I'm going to claim, and I haven't checked this, I'm going to claim that there is no digit that has that code. None of these digits should be 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. Verify that? Yes. There's close ones. This one's close. This one's close, but they're not. So if you're a barcode reader and you see this pattern, and it doesn't show up in your list, you say, oh, the whole thing must be backwards. And you can just flip the whole code and then read it the other way. So it kind of is self-correcting in that way. By making all the codes unique, you can tell if you're reading forward or backwards. All right. So then we encode it in ink. There's the example. There's the close-up. So let me try this. I have like five more minutes to get through this. So I wrote a program that goes through this process for us. Where you can give it the manufacturer's, the 6-digit manufacturer code and the 5-digit item code. It will then draw the barcode using, because it's easy, it's just the rules that I said, there's nothing magic here. So I just wrote a program that just draws bars at the different widths. And then this, the tricky part for me was figuring out how to lay out the digits so that they actually looked like a barcode. It was easy to do it without this. This is what took me all the time. So what I would like is somebody find something that you have that has a UPC barcode on it. Notebook, probably clothing doesn't have it so much. Like a cigarette pack, is that what it is? Okay. You have gum? Does it have this 12-digit code? No. Some of them, if they're not for individual sales, is it?
That is 6.
Just 6 altogether? Yeah, sometimes they do their own internal. You've got 6 also. I tell you they're the most popular code, and then you prove me wrong. Okay, all right, don't tell me the last digit. All right, so here's what I want. This is kind of like a magic trick, except, you know, not all that interesting. So tell me the first 6 digits, starting with the one that's hanging off to the left.
8, 4, 2, 2, 5, 9.
Okay, and then the last 5 digits, and leave off the one that's hanging off the side.
4, 4, 2, 9, 6.
All right, so from what we've heard about today, we're thinking that 8, I forget what 8 meant. I think 8 means it's just some product. The rest of that should tell us who manufactured that code. I actually could look that up. I'm not going to look that up. Because I have the database of all the manufacturers. So this tells us the manufacturer. Then the manufacturer assigned this to the particular item that we're talking about. And if we hit enter. Okay, so that should be the barcode. Now here's the thing that I want you to check. Is this digit, you didn't tell me this digit. Did we get it right?
No.
We've never met before, I assure you. Can I say?
You said to me wrong the first time I met.
No. You have to tell me. No, the first one you gave me, the 8. It's up there. Oh, interesting. There's... How many did you start there? 8, 4, 2, 2, 5, 9, 3. 4, 4, 2, 9, 6, 8. That's 13 digits. It's made in Spain. It says made in Spain. I don't know why. Okay. Everything in my house had 12 digits. Anybody else find anything when you were looking? Yeah, what do you got? It's another note.
Yeah, it's
another
one.
And is it 12 digits?
Yeah. Like, well, not including the last.
Including the last one, it should be 12. Not including the last one, it's 11.
Okay.
It's what?
12.
Okay, let's try this one more time before we all completely lose patience with me and my ability to do magic. You already gave up on me being able to do jokes. All right, what do you got?
0, 4, 3, 1, 0, 0.
Oh, I know what it is. It is because it's from Spain. So the database has in it a bunch of things that start with 0. That all the ones from the U.S. all start with 0. And then they extended the code 1 to cover international stuff. I bet that's the power. I should have just left off that digit off. Anyway, sorry, back to you. How far did I get?
And then there's
2 more 0. Sorry, say again.
2 more 0.
0, 0 on this first guy? Okay.
07048.
All right, and you didn't tell me the check digit,
but
we're going to say it's a 1. Yes! Okay, all right. And do the bars look exactly like this? Sure, they all look exactly like this. They're completely indistinguishable to my eye. But I claim that if we printed this out and brought it to the store, they would charge us for a notebook. Which I don't know what the advantage of that is. Anyway, so I'm going to try to make this program available to you just so you can just putz around with it. Supposedly, people can actually print these out and put them over a label. Like, print it out, say it's a pen, but it's actually, say, a radial tire. You know, and then get it. That would be an ethics. All right, so... Let me just wrap up. Making those finished up rustling sounds. All right, so to summarize, we had a product name, we turned it into 11-digit code. The 11-digit code was then 12 digits by adding a check digit. The 12 digits became a 95-bit sequence, which then became ink with black being 0 and white being, or sorry, black being 1 and white being 0. You just reverse this process and you can actually figure out what the product is, and that's what the scanners actually do. They scan it, they pick up patterns of zeros and ones, or they pick up patterns of ink, they turn it into zeros and ones, they turn it into numbers, they check the check digit, and then they look it up in a database. All about reduction. All right, so for next time, pick up a book and the eye clicker, read the preface from the book and chapter 1, but not all chapter 1. You might have to go up to and including bits and logic blocks, because that's what I'm going to be talking about next time. And I'll do a brief iClicker quiz on the material so that, just so that I'll be reassured that the book is being read, because it's a nice book. Right, that was before you came in. So the bookstore should have the books, but they should also have these devices. They're like the remote controls. You can tell me what. Yes.
I have another clicker required for another class. It was completely different. Are they still compatible?
If it's the iClicker, you can use it. If it's not the iClicker, it probably won't work. And this is the shame of when we live. Because 5 years from now, they're all going to be able to talk to each other. But now I don't. Do you know if it's iClicker?
I don't know. I'll have to look at it.
There's a group of professors who got together to try to choose the same clickers as much as we could, because that way you can amortize the cost, use it for the same class. You'll be the guinea pig. See if it works out. All right. Thank you so much for coming. Hope to see you next week.